Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life. Hello and welcome to Namaste Radio. I am your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. We are here with Eckhart Tolle live on the air, and it's going to be a wonderful and exciting 90 minutes. We have done our best to compile questions from a wide variety of people, questions that have been coming up again and again and again. And so I do hope that your questions are answered tonight with Eckhart Tolle. And you've seen him on Oprah. You've read his books, The Power of Now and A New Earth. Eckhart was born in Germany and educated in the United Kingdom. And at the age of 29, he had a profound inner transformation that completely changed the course of his life. And the rest is history. And he is here with us this evening. Hello, Eckhart.
Hello, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
Thank you. Good, thanks. Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to let everyone know that you can join in the chat room, and there's lots of people chatting right now in the live chat through Blog Talk Radio. And if you have more questions that you would like to discuss after the show, go to namastepublishing.com. There's going to be a discussion board open there where you can discuss the happenings of the show. Eckhart, you also have EckhartTolle.tv happening?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit more about that later on in the show, but I wanted to put that out there so I remember. And we have a limited amount of time, so I'm just going to jump right in with the questions, if that's all right with you.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. When you wrote The Power of Now and A New Earth, the world felt like a different place. A lot's gone on since then, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you'd like to add or amend to your teachings in the face of the current global climate.
Well, The Power of Now came out in 98, if I remember. No, was it 98? If I remember correctly, yes, I think it was. And The New Earth came out about 6 years ago. Yes, the world has changed since then. New challenges, new problems. It doesn't really affect the essential teaching that's expressed in both books, because the teaching does not address or seek to remedy or solve the problems out there in the world. The focus of the teaching is human consciousness. And the world that we create out of our inherent state of consciousness, collective consciousness. So if we create a world that seems to be full of insurmountable problems, then that world has been created by us collectively out of a certain state of consciousness. And so the focal point of the books and the teaching is a shift in human consciousness. So it does not actually address any external problems, because the way I see it is that all external problems are effect. They are in the realm of effect. Now, what I address in the books is the realm of cause. and the cause is within each human being. So I point out, I've done so frequently, that if you look at human history, it's a very sorry tale. It looks like the history of insanity, and anybody who doubts that, I always say go to just the 20th century is enough. Go and read a book on 20th century history and you see how insane it is. How many humans have been killed by other humans? Far in excess of 100 million. So the essential thing is the recognition that there is a certain element or strong element of insanity within the human consciousness. And so we create a world that is full of problems because of a dysfunction in our state of consciousness. So the books really address that dysfunction in our state of consciousness and point to the possibility of a transformation of consciousness in each human being. So not as a collective thing, because the collectivity consists of individuals. The change has to be carried out within the individual. I don't have any collective program, so it's the individual. And the first recognition of the individual is the individual needs to recognize his or her own dysfunctions in consciousness, rather than always saying the world out there is so insane and other people are so unconscious and insane. Well, the suggestion is to look within first. Are there elements of dysfunction or insanity in myself? So it's becoming aware of your inner life, which means your thoughts and your emotions. That's where it all starts. So you become aware of what kind of thoughts your mind generates. You become aware of reactive patterns in you that operate. You react against things and people and events. You become aware of deep-seated mental patterns that are often very negative. So the teaching then focuses on a new dimension that can arise in human consciousness. And that is where salvation lies. When humans discover, the individual has to discover it within him or herself, that there is, in addition to all the thoughts that go through my head every day, the emotions that I experience, my reactions, my whatever happens to me in the world, my physical health, my life situation, my financial situation, my relationships, what I usually call my life. Now that's, in addition to that, there is a transcendent dimension in each human being. If you don't discover that transcendent dimension, now I sometimes call it presence, or I call it awareness. Spiritual traditions have also pointed to that and have used different names to speak of it. If you don't discover that transcendent dimension in yourself, that state of consciousness, the deeper consciousness, whether you call it deeper or higher, doesn't matter, it's a question of perspective. That's where, with the recognition of that dimension in you, the dysfunction dissolves. Without the recognition of that dimension within you, no matter what you do on the outer level, or no matter how you rearrange your thoughts, the dysfunction will remain. So we come to the core then of the teaching, which has nothing to do really with any historical situation, because you'll see that essentially the same teaching was already expressed by the Buddha 2,600 years ago and by many other teachers. That nothing to do with any historical situation. if there's no shift in human consciousness, then people, I'm sure, will continue to read New Earth and the Power of Now. And just not long ago on my Eckhart Tolle TV, I was discussing a book called Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, and that was written 2,000 years ago. And we are still reading it now, and it's still relevant now. Books that contain that essence and point to the essence, they are always relevant no matter what the historical situation is. So I must add, I very much hope that in the year 4000, which would be 2,000 years from now, people will not be reading The Power of Now and A New Earth because it won't be necessary anymore. That's my hope. But you never know. If the shift, if a true permanent shift has not happened by then, people would still be reading The Power of Now in a totally changed historical situation, but it would still be relevant because that is not related to externals. So that's the core then, the discovery within yourself of the level of presence, awareness, the transcendent dimension. And perhaps we can, as we speak this evening, we can go more deeply into that, what that means, what that is, so that it's not just a concept in your mind, a word, the transcendent dimension, or something to believe in. That's not what it is. It's something to discover that's always there, already there within you, but is overlooked continuously. So I'm not going yet into great detail because I believe that will probably emerge in the course of our conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you, Eckhart. I'm just noticing in the chat room that some people are having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. So if it's possible for you to put your phone a little bit closer to your mouth,
yes.
I know you have such a lovely, soft-spoken voice, and it's sometimes a little bit difficult to over the
yes.
internet to hear
so
that.
It's not quite close. I hope it's more audible now.
Okay. Thank you. So you were just talking about how, I mean, it is funny how 2,000 books that were written 2,000 years ago are still relevant today because we still haven't got it, and I'm wondering, how do you think we as a human race are doing on our journey to higher consciousness? I mean, we've been taking so long to try and figure it out. Are we developing quickly enough to save ourselves, in your opinion?
Well, that's a good question. The question can be answered on different levels. Let's begin with the good news, that is, let's answer the question from the highest level of understanding and of reality. And from that highest level of understanding, we are already saved. Every human being is already saved. Now, what does that mean? It means the essence of every human being is formless, indestructible, and eternal. So the essence of who you are, and again, it's not something to believe in, it's something to realize for yourself. This connects with the first question. This is not something to believe in, not a set of beliefs. I believe that I am eternal, that's not enough. It's a realization within yourself of that level of the timeless and the formless. And so this is quite a relief to know that ultimately, as the Course in Miracles puts it at the very beginning, I don't know, many of the listeners may be familiar with the Course in Miracles. Some may like it, some may not like it. It's not for everybody, and that's fine. But the Course in Miracles is summarized at the very beginning in two sentences or three sentences, and it says, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. And so it says, if you understand those three brief sentences, deeply within yourself, then you don't need to study the Course in Miracles, of course, or any any other spiritual teaching. So essentially then, when I say we are already saved, it means that we are all emanations of the One, temporary emanations appearing in form of an underlying oneness, the One, formless, timeless life. We could call it God, but because that word has such a heavy history and has been misused so much, I usually avoid the word God, but sometimes I still use it. As long as it doesn't bring up the image in people's minds of a man sitting on a cloud with a beard. God is the formless one life out of which all forms of life emerge. So you and God are not two. You are essentially one with that one timeless, eternal life, life itself, you could call it, or consciousness itself, the formless, that which underlies and pervades all forms. So on that level, then, there's nothing to worry about, because no matter what happens on the level of form, essentially, death is an illusion, because death is no more than the dissolution of form. And so, good, now that we have settled that, we don't need to go into a panic and say, oh, the world situation is so dreadful, it's all going to collapse. And even if it does, it, in absolute terms, it doesn't matter, because consciousness is evolving in this universe through countless avenues, through countless forms. That's where the universe is an expression of the evolution of consciousness. And no matter where you go in the universe, I haven't traveled there, but I'm sure no matter where you go, even to another galaxy, you will see that there is an evolution happening of forms arising and forms becoming more conscious of the source. The universe itself is becoming more conscious. So when a human being becomes more conscious, then really what's happening is the universe, or life, or God, is becoming more conscious through you. So, and some people say, well, that's sacrilege. God does not need to become more conscious. Well, in the timeless, God is already complete and fulfilled. There's no change in that ultimate reality. But somehow this ultimate reality is flowing into the world of form, creating forms for some reason. I don't know whether anybody can understand the ultimate reason why it's doing that, but it's what it's doing. And we are part of that unfoldment of evolution on the level of form. And even if certain forms become destroyed, evolution will seek other avenues. The evolution of consciousness will flow into other channels. But no gain in consciousness is ever lost. So that's good then. So how are we doing not from the ultimate level of understanding, from a lower level of understanding? What's going to happen to human civilization? Now, I usually don't predict things, but what we do know, of course, is that we are faced with a multitude of seemingly insurmountable problems. There's the problem of the destruction of the environment, or global warming, there's the problem of overpopulation, there's the problem of nuclear weapons proliferation despite treaties and so on, the continuing and growing danger of that. Ultimately, it could happen that a certain country will begin to use them. There's the the problem of institutions that are dysfunctional and are about to collapse. I mentioned one of the few predictions I make in the new earth is say that many of the institutions and that we have created, whether it's government or economy or social institutions, many of them, because they've come out of that old egoic consciousness or unconsciousness, are going to dissolve. So, and then a little later the financial collapse happened, and of course the financial, this is just one example of the things that are, as we are going through this period of intense change, many of the structures are going to dissolve because the structures are old. They cannot be vehicles for the arising, awakening consciousness in human beings. So when a structure cannot be a vehicle, it cannot accommodate the new energy, then the structure collapses. The prime example of that, the huge collapse that happened when Soviet communism collapsed, nobody predicted it. Nobody predicted that it would happen so quickly. The system seemed totally solid, as if it was going to last at least 1,000 years. It was immobile, it was heavy and solid, and yet within a few years, it dissolved. The financial markets, everything looked so solid. The banks and so on, people invested their money, and then they sought out what's the most solid place that I can think of where I can invest my money. What's the water? What's more solid than ice? Let's put it into Iceland. And then the whole country, the whole financial sector, the whole country collapsed. So there's nothing solid anymore. It's an illusion if you think there's still something solid. And that is the cause of fear for many people.
Eckhart,
sorry
to interrupt you. I'm really curious because I know that you know this and you live this all the time. But, I mean, you are human. Do you get worried about these things in the physical world?
No, I don't worry about the things in the physical world because I know that ultimately all will be well and all is already well from the highest perspective. I am concerned sometimes. I feel sometimes sad when I see what's happening. But I don't worry about it. I contemplate it. I watch the news most days, and I'm just there being present with it. And the thing is not to what you're being told every day is that you should be fearful. They might not be saying that explicitly, but the whole undertone of when you listen to the news is that this is all very fearful and this is all bad news. Ultimately, it's not bad news when a tremendous transformation is happening. Yes, it can be very challenging for the individual, but it is necessary for our world to become transformed. And it is happening because there is an inner shift happening in human beings. There's always a correspondence between inner and outer. And I know that, and therefore I don't worry about it. I contemplate it. I try to point out to people that this is not a fearful thing. And I point out that when challenges come, because when things that you had relied on could dissolve or collapse, let's say your investments, you relied on your investments for your old age. No, I'm not saying this should be taken lightly, but every challenge can potentially be an awakener, and that is something for human beings to learn. And actually, human beings do not awaken except through challenges, through encountering challenges. I know that for myself, and I know that many people who come to these teachings they come because they have already been challenged, they've already gone through suffering, and that has created in them a readiness and an opening. And so, no, I'm not worried, but let's see what happens. From the normal point of view, it doesn't look good. There will be many things happening that don't look good from a conventional perspective. But if you look at it from a larger context, it is about transformation. Drastic change externally, but more importantly, transformation internally in human beings. And this is why this teaching and the books and some other teachings that also point to the essence, there's so many people receptive to it now. So many people write to me and say, my life is changing, or my life has changed. I've let go of unhappiness. My relationships have improved. I'm no longer sleepless. I'm no longer spending sleepless nights worrying about my life. So things, there's greater empathy happening with others, less identification in those who are going through that change, less identification with mind, with thoughts, which is a vital part of the transformation, to step out of identification with the continuous stream of thinking. The continuous stream of thinking that with the ego, identification with that is the ego. The ego has created the structures of this world over hundreds of years, thousands of years. So those structures were created out of that dysfunctional state of consciousness. Now, sometimes when you look at the structures when they're still working, they look functional, but they are in essence dysfunctional because they've come out of the egoic state of consciousness, which is ultimately dysfunctional. And that's what is dissolving in humans. And something else is arising. But so it's vital to realize that and to open yourself to that, because if you resist the change that is happening on an inner level in the collective consciousness, if your ego is so rigid that you resist change, and then that means enormous amount of suffering for you, fear, anxiety, and so on. But if you welcome change and not judge it as something negative, even if it's challenging, it's not negative, then you begin to live in a state of acceptance of what is. And that's a vital part of this teaching, acceptance of the isness of this moment, because it already is as it is. Whatever is already the case. Now, that sounds like a strange statement, but of course it is obviously true. So, this is one way, and this connects us to the first answer, the answer I gave to your first question. When you begin to live in that changed, transformed state of consciousness where you're no longer in continuous resistance and denial of the present moment and no longer totally identified with the continuous stream of thinking in your head, so that you inhabit a conceptual reality no more, through which everything is judged immediately, every human being, every situation. You do it to yourself too. You judge yourself, you judge others, you judge other groups, political parties, continuous judgments. You don't know what you're doing because you're so identified with the stream of thinking, which is really every thought is a judgment. And you completely...
Hello, Eckhart?
What?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear what you just said.
Can you hear the stories you create in your mind, continuous judgments? So that is something to step out of and see that you are continuously, nothing personal here, by the way, when I say you, continuously denying the simplicity of what is now, the present moment, denying the present moment, running away, judging it, condemning it. And so the shift is possible if we come to a different relationship with the present moment, where we're no longer antagonistic towards the present moment. We are no longer
Hello?
Can you hear?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit.
So we're no longer treating the present moment as if it were an enemy or an obstacle. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a shift happening when you come to a place of acceptance of what is. Then something opens up inside you, which I sometimes call space or stillness. These are just words or pointers. We could use others. When you accept what is, suddenly you become the space for what is, whether it's your thoughts or your emotions or something that's happening externally in your life, another human being doing this or that, or a group of human beings that doing this or that. They are doing what they are doing, no matter whether you complain or condemn them, they are doing what they are doing. So you come to a place of, well, that's what is, that's what they do, this is what this moment presents. And so you become comfortable with the present moment, which is life itself. And then the shift in consciousness accelerates because you consciously cooperate with this evolutionary impulse that's happening anyway. So it's you consciously cooperate with the shift in consciousness that wants to happen. It's far more, it's not a personal thing. It is something that happens through you, through the form as which you appear for a little while. A shift in consciousness that happens through you. It goes far beyond anything personal. So what we can then cooperate with that which wants to happen and is happening, open ourselves to the influx of a new consciousness, which is what I spoke about earlier, what I sometimes call the transcendental dimension of consciousness or awareness or presence. And this can be experienced even right now. It's usually overlooked by people because they're looking for something more important out there. But if you can become aware of what are the ingredients at this moment of the content of this moment, what is the content of this moment? You're listening to my voice. You can see what's in the room where you are. You feel yourself breathing. You may have certain thoughts going through your head. You may have certain feelings that arise and subside. You may feel your body sitting there. These are the things that are happening in, they constitute the content of this present moment. And if you don't resist it, if you allow it to be, then you realize in a very subtle way that there is an additional element here that is not part of the content of the present moment, but it allows the content of whatever is to be. And that which allows whatever is to be, which we could call the space for what is, which we could call the consciousness that is the formless, timeless consciousness without which there would be no voice at this moment that you're listening to. There would be no room around you. There would be no body to feel. So there's a vital ingredient here that's usually overlooked. And that aspect or that dimension is the formless dimension in you. And so that is the realization of that. You can actually sense that at this moment. In addition to the content of this moment, what is it that enables the content of this moment to be? And that's a question that you cannot answer intellectually or conceptually. The answer to that question, what is it that allows the content of this moment to be, can only be realized experientially in you. And so, what is it? Well, there is a, could we call it the light of consciousness in which it all appears? Yes, we could call it that. Jesus used the word light. He said, not only did he say, I am the light of the world, talking about himself, he also said, you are the light of the world, that which illuminates everything, and that is the formless dimension, and that can be experienced at this moment. It underlies whatever arises at this moment. It is the space for it. It has no form. It is not connected to our sense of time. It is timeless. It is who you are. It is consciousness itself, pure consciousness itself. So you are that in essence. And this is a wonderful realization that this is ultimately also where your sense of identity comes from. Which usually people think, who am I? Well, I'm this and that and that, your profession and your history and your name and your suffering and your complaints and your unhappinesses, all that is a bundle, you tie it up together and says, that's me. No, that is going to dissolve very quickly. But is there something to you that is not subject to decay and time? That's the essence of all spiritual teachings. And where is that? Well, that's essentially the essence of who you are. This is where your sense of identity actually derives from, when you have this sense of something very precious that I am. It gets mixed up in people's minds with their story, with form. That sense of beingness or essence, I am-ness, I am, of beingness, formless, but vitally alive. That gets mixed up with a story you're telling yourself in your head. But without the consciousness behind it, you couldn't even be telling yourself any stories in your head about who you are or about who others are. So what is the essence of the story? Consciousness. So it's the realization, then the shift is happening, the shift in consciousness happens when we realize that in addition to all the stuff in our lives, let's call it stuff, all this, and there's so much stuff in people's lives, all the dysfunctional stuff, and the objects they accumulate, I'm not saying don't buy any objects, no, but don't lose yourself in them. There's the emotional stuff, the completely senseless suffering they create for themselves and others, out of nothing, dreadful, continuously arising stuff. and my life, my problems, my future, my past, all so difficult. My past is so heavy, and my future is so uncertain and fearful. And you wake up in the middle of the night, scared. Why are you scared? Because all that you know is stuff, and stuff is not going to last for very long. And you've overlooked and are overlooking the eternal in you. Well, you cannot, the eternal is not something that you can find as if it were an object or even an experience. I want to have the ultimate experience. Now, if you want that, you're not going to find the ultimate experience because you're looking for something that you think you don't have yet. And even if you find a great fireworks experience, after a little while, you'll come to the end of the fireworks, and then you come down again and say, oh, I thought that was the enlightenment experience, and I lost it. No, it was only something arising in form. That's fine. That's how the world of form works. But can you find something that is already in you, as you, is already that which enables everything to be? Now, that's consciousness, if we want to put a word to it. But let's not fall into the mistake of believing that when we've called it something, we know what it is. You have to experience consciousness directly as yourself. Now, this moment, between two thoughts, or between two sentences right now, I'm going to just be quiet for 3 seconds. That's consciousness. I'll be quiet again for another 3 or 5 seconds. That's consciousness. It has no content. For a moment, it has no content. This is space. Now, scientists might tell you, well, that's not really anything. That's created by the chemical soup in your brain. But what is it that created the brain, the most intricate, the most complex thing on earth? Was it created out of nothing? There's an enormous amount of intelligence already gone into the creation of the brain. So the consciousness precedes everything. Everything, the evolution comes out of that. The intelligence comes out of that. It's not produced by form. Form is produced, created by the underlying intelligence, and then which is consciousness. I'm not talking about conceptual intelligence, but the essence of intelligence. It's in you already now. You can call it stillness. You can call it presence. You can call it beingness, aliveness, a sense of I am. Not this or that, just I am. Can you feel that you are? Not this or that, you are I am. That's consciousness. That's the essence of your identity, and that's the awakening. When you realize that dimension, then the stuff world is no longer so threatening. And the stuff world, by what I say that, I mean all the stuff in this world that makes up your so-called life. Then it's other people, situations, the finances, your job, or the lack of it, the place where you live, any thoughts that go to your head. You're no longer in the grip of these things anymore. Yes, they are still there. Yes, they may still be challenging. But you are no longer lost in that stuff. Stuff includes all your thoughts. It's the world of form. You are no longer lost in the world of form. And so then that's a great relief. Then you can operate in the world of form with much greater ease and with greater creativity and aliveness and a sense of goodness and empathy with others, because you're not reducing others to their form. You recognize the formless in the other. You can sense it because you can sense your own formless consciousness. And so you relate to the formless in the other. Even if the form might be pretty mad, you can still, through the madness, you can sense the sanity in the other, which is they too are just an expression of that divine consciousness the one life, the one consciousness that may be temporarily obscured by an illusion, the illusion that form is all they are. And then you start fighting. Then you start having to protect the form that you think is all you have and all you are. And then you create this world. And then greed arises, because to strengthen the illusory form identity, you need more. I need more of this and more of that. And dissatisfaction arises, because you're never fully satisfied, because you haven't found yourself. All you know is stuff, form. So this is the essence of transformation. This is that. And it's so wonderful that now, for the first time, there is a large-scale opening into that in human beings. Individuals, isolated individuals here and there, have found it throughout history, but never large numbers. But now, for the first time, large numbers of people are going through this transformation, where they begin to realize who they are beyond the form. And so that's the good news.
Well, Eckhart, there's so many questions that I want to ask you, and our time is limited tonight. I'm sure we have enough questions for 10 shows. And maybe you'll say this is irrelevant, because when you get down to that transcendental dimension of stillness, none of this matters. But I think a lot of people who are living in the physical world will want to hear the answer to this question, so I'm going to ask you. I heard of a New Thought minister who lost her congregation when she was diagnosed with cancer. People figured that if she was so spiritual, she should be able to heal herself, or maybe she shouldn't have even have attracted an illness in the first place. And even the scientific community has found some evidence of spiritual health and mental health being related to physical health. So why do people who are spiritual and who live more in that space of stillness, why do some of them still get physically ill in their bodies?
Yes, that's an interesting question. The minister that you mentioned just now, who had cancer, and then people didn't want to listen to her anymore. That, of course, there's a tradition, I think it started in the 19th century, of equating spirituality with physical healing. And that started, I would say, in the 19th century when science was considered to be the answer of everything, and really some spiritual people suddenly felt inadequate because science became so powerful suddenly. And science said that you inhabit a material, absolutely real material reality, and that's all there is, because that's all we can measure. So a reality became a material reality for people, and science could prove to you, it did experiments, it could show you this and that, and they were beginning to deny anything that could not be measured, that was not material. So they were beginning to believe in the absolute reality of the material universe, and that is a 19th century thing. And then only as we went into the 20th century with Einstein and modern physics, a completely different thing happened. We began to see that what we consider to be the physical universe is not actually matter, actually is not solid at all and has no absolute reality. It is an illusory perception of energy forms, one could say. But when spiritual movements arose at that time, because they suddenly felt inadequate in the face of science, first of all, they started to use the word science to describe their teachings. So that was the arising of Christian Science, and again, and then great emphasis was put on healing, as if healing were the essence of spirituality, or the criterion by which one could measure one's degree of spirituality. And not now, some of these teachings are actually quite beautiful and profound, but with them there is a certain lack of balance, and that includes even such wonderful teachings as are expressed, for example, by Joel Goldsmith, the spiritual teacher. I love him very much. But again, he came out of a tradition of Christian Science, and a very important part of his teaching also was the healing of the physical body. And he had a heart attack one day, and it had to be kept secret. Nobody was allowed to talk about it. As if the heart attack contradicted the entire teaching. And that was because there was an imbalance here, that undoubtedly, there is a correlation between one's inner state of consciousness and the physical, and undoubtedly, for many people, many illnesses, and even the mainstream doctors are beginning to admit and see that and realize that many diseases are created by dysfunctional states of consciousness, of extremely negative states of consciousness, negative thinking, continuous indulging in negative emotions, stress, a great contributor to disease, cause of disease. And so it's an accepted fact now that stress, which is a dysfunctional state of consciousness, very normal these days, but we need to see that it's a form of madness. To live in an almost continuous state of stress is madness, and of course it interferes with the functioning of the body. So on the one hand, yes, there's a lot we can do to improve health by living free of dysfunctional states, especially negativity, stress, and so on, so that a more harmonious state of consciousness arises. And again, we must just go back to what I talked about a little earlier. The only way a truly harmonious state of consciousness can arise is by realizing the deeper dimension in you, that is presence, that is consciousness, that is formless. And only by living in conscious connection with that, being rooted in that formless being, that formless consciousness, in that inner stillness, then all these anxieties that are otherwise normal, all this, the stresses begin to go out of your life, and there is usually an improvement in your state of health. But there are other factors also that come into play, and that is, they could be called karmic. They could be part of the collective karma of humanity that expresses itself through you, that you are part of. They could be called genetic or whatever it is. Presence can dissolve a lot of accumulated past in you, that state of consciousness of being aware, present, not identified with thinking continuously, but that dissolves the past. And that's what is called, we could call healing, physical healing, can happen and does happen a lot through presence. But there may be accumulations of past in you that go back such a long time that they cannot be dissolved all through presence, that they remain, or they may be part of what you carry, part of the collective karma of humanity or your race or whatever it is. And so it happens that even people who are quite present and awake can still contract illness, and that does not invalidate their spiritual realization. healing can be great. Physical healing is a wonderful thing. It happens when it happens, but we must not fall into the danger of overvaluing spiritual healing. Jesus healed quite a few people, but that was not the essence of his teaching. It was a byproduct of his teaching. And of course, the healing of the physical body is fine, and then after a few years, you die anyway. So even if there is healing, even those traditions that emphasize the importance of physical healing, they sometimes neglect the far greater importance of the transformation of consciousness. So I can heal 100 people, but if their consciousness has not become transformed, they have not awakened out of identification with thinking and emotions and their stuff, then a few years later they die. Okay, it prolonged their life a little, but there was no true transformation here. So healing is it's wonderful when it happens. We must not fall into the trap of overvaluing just physical healing. Physical healing is often a byproduct of a transformation of consciousness, but not always. Sometimes there are other factors. There's an Indian teaching about karma, which says that it is often the case that a human being, even though the human being may have awakened spiritually, still have to endure the effects of past karma. I think that is sometimes true or partly true. And the analogy they have is they have the image of an arrow that has left the bow. And you cannot stop an arrow that has left the bow. And by that they mean it's the karma that your body has come into this world with. I believe that in some cases that can be dissolved on the physical aspect of that, but in other cases it may not. It may be like the arrow that has left the bow and is just on its way. And that is fine. Now, a wonderful thing happens when an awakened human being encounters physical suffering of that kind or any other form of suffering and brings presence to it, then whatever happens in your consciousness also affects the totality of consciousness. So any human being who is confronted with challenges, let's including physical challenges, but brings absolute acceptance and presence to it and remains absolutely open and clear and not accepting of the idea that I'm ill, just accepting of what is at this moment, then what happens then is a lot of old stuff is being dissolved through this one seemingly human being that brings presence to pain, for example, or presence to a certain area of unconsciousness. Then that has a huge impact on the totality of consciousness. So one could say that when you're awake and despite that you still encounter physical suffering, then it intensifies your presence. I have personally met a number of people who were close to death through cancer, through AIDS, and other illnesses. And in the last few months of their lives, they went through an incredible transformation of consciousness. And when I talked to them and met them, there was a radiant being there. One could almost visually see the light coming through the dissolving form, their body. One could almost see and definitely sense the light of consciousness coming through the dissolving form. Why was this happening? Because they completely surrendered and accepted the isness of whatever is at this moment, the pain, whatever. Their ego eroded, because the ego, when you are accepting and surrendered, that erodes the ego. And so it sometimes happens that a physical illness can be the most important thing that happens to you spiritually, because it can bring about the complete flowering of that human being. Another thing that can do that, by the way, is old age. As you become older and the body becomes weaker, again, if there is a letting go of resistance, a disidentification from mind, from thinking, from past, then there's suddenly a light shines through, and which is the light of consciousness. And so you get some old people who emanate this wonderful peace and aliveness. And then that is the fulfillment of the consciousness is flowering through them. So consciousness can flower also through physical illness or old age. And old age, of course, is often accompanied by physical illness or breakdown of certain parts of the body. So that it can be a wonderful transformation. So we have the two, again, just to summarize, yes, it is true that healing often happens through bringing presence into your life and no longer living in negative states and no longer living in stress. And if it doesn't, then you welcome whatever arises, not the illness, not the idea of illness, just what is at this moment, discomfort, pain, disability, is what is. That's what is. That's it is. And then that brings about transformation. So that's really how it is. And so let's not fall into the mistake of equating necessarily spirituality with physical healing. So they are often related, yes, but not necessarily and not always. There have been great, as you probably know, there have been great teachers who in the end fell ill and suffered. Well, they didn't really suffer because they lived in complete surrender, but there might have been pain. Suffering, what I call suffering, is the psychological part of the pain, that which resists the pain. Even
well, thank
the Buddha
you so.
Is that
oh,
is a site of food poisoning.
Oh my goodness!
And I'm sure that's a true story because there's and somehow it crept in. It usually people invent all kinds of fantastic legends about their teachers over the centuries, and sometimes a little bit of truth remains that shows that oh, that was a normal human being who transcended. And so it's wonderful when I read that the Buddha, who on the one hand they say when he came out of the womb, the baby that came out of the womb said, I've come here for the salvation of the world. Now obviously the human fantasy is creating some kind of super being. And then the reality remains that this super being suddenly died of food poisoning. And there's the real Buddha, a little bit of the real Buddha left. And so the Buddha was a human being who awakened. That's all, not a superhuman, gigantic, and that's the beauty of it.
Well, Eckhart, it's time for us to call our three listeners who have presented some questions. Before we do that, I know you wanted to speak for a moment about Eckhart Tolle TV. So what's going on with Eckhart Tolle TV?
Well, that's an interesting experiment, and it's funny that I should be part of that because I'm completely computer illiterate, and yet people are doing it for me, and they came to me with that interesting idea that using the internet to transmit spiritual teaching into people's living rooms, sometimes live, sometimes recorded sessions, so that one could use the internet, which is also magnifies, at least the internet, when you look at it, as everybody knows, it magnifies on the one hand human madness. There's so much that's mad on the internet. On the other hand, there may be a possibility here for spirit to use it in a more positive way and to bring, make it part of the spiritual transformation. So what that does then is people tune into the Eckhart Tolle TV and they get the teaching transmitted into their living rooms. I've had to learn to look into the camera, because the camera, I couldn't do that at first because it's not a human being. But I now visualize a wormhole, and so I look into the camera, into the wormhole, and I know that at the other end of the wormhole there's a human being. And I talk to this one human being. And that I'm quite beginning to enjoy that. So it's using the internet as a spiritual vehicle, and I regard it still as an experiment. I still want to see how many people find it useful and what the outcome of it is, but it's an enjoyable experiment, and it's a thing of transforming something that otherwise contributes to the madness of the old consciousness. Why not use that and help, see if it can help in the awakening of human beings. So that's my experiment with the computer illiterate person experimenting with that.
So that's EckhartTolle.tv?
Yes, I think it is. It's on my website, EckhartTolle.com, and then they can get information on that.
Wonderful. Well, are we ready to take our next?
And of course, yes, we are. Of course, we're doing it here, too. We're using, I think this is called the Internet, too, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So we're using it here, too. So there are wonderful things happening on it, and it's good to know.
Wonderful. Yes. Are we ready to speak with our caller?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm dialing Kathleen. Hopefully she'll pick up right away.
Hello.
Hi, is this Kathleen?
Yes, it is.
Hi, you're on the air with Eckhart Tolle. Go ahead, what's your question?
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. My question is, what is the relationship between sex and the pain body?
Oh.
Juicy one.
Well, I'm sure many people will find that an interesting question. So the, as most people know, the pain body is, one could say, the emotional part of the dysfunctional ego, and the pain body is an energy field, like almost an entity that consists of accumulations of past emotional pain or suffering. And that emotional negativity, suffering or pain has a certain frequency. And so it is an energy form. Through working with people, I came to that realization that people carry inside, some to a greater extent than others, people carry inside this energy field that thrives on drama and unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite a realization for me when I saw that people got periodically taken over by that entity. And by entity, I mean it's an energy field. It is the frequency, the energetic frequency of pain. And that painful thing that lives in humans as an energy field, because everything is energy, there's nothing spooky about it. Every thought is an energy form. Every emotion is an energy form. So here you have an accumulation of emotion, and that's the pain body that is not, in most people, not there constantly, but it gets triggered, and then it comes up, and it takes you over, and it feeds. What it feeds on is pain, emotional pain, drama, and it loves that. You could also call it the addiction to unhappiness that is in many human beings, not perhaps continuously, but periodically, which many couples find they go through periodically, pain body episodes when they go through huge emotional drama and fights. and then pain body mutually energize each other. The pain body wants to experience more pain. So the human being, when it gets taken over, becomes unconscious. Now, it can sometimes happen that this energy field, the pain body, links into the sexual center. And then there comes the connection between the need of the pain body to experience pain with sexual energy. So the most obvious thing, obviously, that comes to mind when one talks about that is that the experience of pain as pleasure. Now, this is what the pain body does, whether it's linked into the sexual center or not. The pain body always experiences pain as pleasure. It loves pain. So, and whatever you love is pleasurable. It's an absurd thing because you don't like it, but your pain body does.
Mm-hmm.
Your body doesn't like it. Your body suffers. Your health suffers. But the pain body, when it's active in you, it loves it. It wants more of it. It attacks the other. It fights. It complains. It has arguments. You can never argue with it. If you argue with a pain body, have you tried it? It's impossible. So, or rationality is totally impossible. Any rational argument is completely dismissed. So you can't do that. And sometimes then this experiencing pain as pleasure, when the pain body links into the sexual center, then obvious things like that happen then when people, this is one example of where the pain body expresses itself through sexuality, when pain is experienced as pleasurable. So that can be physical pain, and of course that everybody knows it as sadism and masochism. Sadism means when you enjoy the inflicting pain, there's a sexual element to it, and or masochism when you enjoy pain being inflicted on you, and there's a pleasurable sensation in the sex center. And that is when the pain body and sexuality have become linked. But it can also happen, it can happen in couples when they fight, there's a pain body episode. Some couples need that in order to feel sexual desire. So it's in some couples it happens that they need to have some kind of fight so that they can experience suddenly sexual desire, and immediately, or even in the middle of the fight, they make love. And then that subsides, and then they carry on fighting, or maybe the energy of the pain body has exhausted itself temporarily, or it has been recharged by that. So another instance where pain body and sexuality go together, when the pain body has linked into the sexual center, is for some people seek out partners who they know, not on a conscious level, but on a feeling level, the pain body, they seek their partner through their pain body. And this is why sometimes you find a person living with somebody who is violent, or the violent person seeking the kind of person who is the victim,
mm-hmm.
the perpetrator and the victim being attracted to each other, and then finding each other, and then acting out their unconsciousness. This can sometimes happen when you're not conscious of your own pain body, and your pain body has linked into the sexual center, then you may be seeking out somebody as a sexual partner or life partner who you can sense will give you, or rather the pain body can sense that this person will give it what it needs, which is further pain. And so all this is very interesting, and so if the way out of it is obviously to make it conscious, to realize, to become conscious of your own pain body as it arises, bring awareness to it, and then at least you may not be immediately free, but at least you can be there as awareness. And awareness gives you a choice. Awareness can give you a choice of following the impulse that you feel inside your pain body, or saying, I can feel this impulse in my pain body, but my choice is not to follow it, not to act on it. And so then, as the more awareness comes in, the more freedom comes in. Freedom from being controlled by the pain body. It may not go away immediately. Old patterns may remain still for years. It can happen. But at least there's not complete identification anymore with them.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for your question, Kathleen. Oh. Have a great night.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Kathleen. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was wonderful. And we have to keep moving along on to our next caller. I'm just dialing her now. Thank you so much for answering that wonderful, spicy question. Okay, so I'm dialing Suzanne now.
Yes.
Hello?
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air with Eckhart Tolle.
Hello, Mr. Tolle.
Hello, Suzanne.
It is an honor to be speaking with you in this moment. Thank you for taking my call.
Nice to speak to you.
I believe that the children being born during this time are playing a monumental role in the transformation of consciousness that has already started to occur on our planet. I believe that my life purpose is to help teach these children how to live in gratitude with self-love and to be in service to others. Teaching them to be in the present moment is an invaluable tool in this pursuit. So my question is this. What are some simple exercises that can be done with children between the ages of 3 to 6 that will give them an awareness of what it means to be in the present moment?
Ah, thank you. Yes, that's an interesting question and a very important question. I don't know if I have exercises as such, but let's see what comes as I speak. Of course, a very young child lives naturally in the present moment without having a name for it and without even knowing it. But that very quickly then, at the age of 3, I would say, as you also suggest, that begins to change. What happens then is the arising of a conceptual world in the head, so that the child actually wants to know what things are called, which is obviously there's nothing bad about that. It's a natural, normal thing and a necessary thing. The child asks, "What's that?" And it might, "What's that and that?" And what's and then at a later time it starts asking why and wants to see connections between things. And that's all very good, and it's very important, of course, that the parents give the child attention and also answer. What is the danger, of course, is that as the concepts are accumulated in the mind, the names for things and so on, they begin to replace the actual experience of things. And so they begin to also cover up the aliveness of the world around you. Because at first the child looks in astonishment at a flower or a tree or an animal. And it looks, oh, the eyes are big, because it's astonished. It sees the miraculous without calling it miraculous, but it is miraculous. And then at some point the child asks, "What's that?" And at that point, the parents have to be careful so that the child's ability to continue to experience the reality around him or her is not completely covered up and replaced by a conceptual reality in their mind. So that then once you've told a child oh, I mean, that's, what's that? Oh, that's an oak tree. Okay. Oh, that's a tulip. A tulip. It's called a tulip. And then the next time the child goes there and says, tulip, and already it's no longer experiencing the reality of it as clearly, as intensely as before, because there is the word, the name has come there in between. So much so that the spiritual teacher, Krishnamurti, who was a great spiritual teacher in the second half of the 20th century, he once said that, teach the child the name of the bird and he will never see the bird again. That's perhaps a slight exaggeration, but what he means is you have to be very careful with when you give the child concepts, continue to point out to the child the reality that is beyond the concept. It can start with a little thing like when the child comes, what's that? Instead of saying, that is such and such, you say, we call it such and such. Because it isn't such and such. The apple is not an... this is not an apple. There's even there's a surrealist painting, I believe it's by Magritte, and it has a picture of an apple there, and underneath it says, this is not an apple. Of course it isn't, it's a painting of an apple. So if you can keep a space of freedom in the child's mind where you continuously point out, redirect the attention of the child to the experience of it. So even once you've told the child that we call this a tulip, and then encourage the child to continue to experience a tulip, encourage sensory perception and bringing more attention to sensory perception by saying, oh, look, can you see, look at the details? Can you see that? Does it smell? If it doesn't have any smell, try it out. Touch it, but gently. Can you feel that it's alive? Yes. With many things you can do that. You can give the child concepts, but at the same time, keep alive the reality that is beyond concepts for the child. So that's one way of not allowing names and definitions and so on to completely obliterate the aliveness of reality, the child. So that's one important thing you can do. And then a very important part of the child not losing the present moment that the child is born with, not losing it completely, he or she may lose it to some extent temporarily, but your state of consciousness as you speak to the child and as you interact with the child. For example, your ability to listen, I'm giving you something rather than exercises, I'm giving you a more general thing, the importance of listening when you're with a child. Listen to the child, but don't just listen to what the child is saying. Bring to the interaction the energy that is behind the listening, the aware presence. So when the child talks to you, yes, of course you are hearing the words. Yes, of course you are understanding the words that the child is communicating. But don't just interact with the words and find some other words to interact with the child's words. The question is there, as you listen to the words, is there another dimension still present in you that is the awareness that is behind the listening, a spacious, alert awareness? And so the most vital part of your interaction with a child is that underlying field of alert awareness. While you listen to the child, yes, the words may be important or they may not be important. In any case, what is more important than the words is the energy behind the words and the energy behind the listening. You can sense, as you interact with your child, you can sense the presence that you are. And then you begin to sense in the child there is also that presence. And then you keep it alive by bringing that into your relationship with the child. You keep alive that dimension, and you strengthen that dimension in the child. So that's vitally important. We could also call it giving the child attention. This energy can also flow into when you interact with a child and say, for example, well, now you need to undress and put on your pajama, and even while you tell the child to do something, don't get lost in the doing, because if you get lost in the doing, come on, you must get done this. Do you do this now? You haven't done that yet. No. Yes, the doing is important. The being is more important. So be aware of the being behind the doing when you're interacting with your child, or telling your child to do this or not to do this. Sometimes you have to stop a child, but there too, don't lose yourself in the reaction or whatever you're doing. Stay present and continue to feel who you are beyond the surface interactions. Bring your presence. This is the most precious gift you can give to the child, which is ultimately yourself. But most people don't know that. They try to do the best for their child, but since they're not in touch with the deeper dimension of who they are, they cannot truly be with a child. They are only interacting in the realm of mind and emotions. It's not enough. Yes, it's necessary. It's not enough. So you bring your gift to the child is presence. And that's the ultimate teaching, better than any exercise. And then the rest will arise out of presence. Whatever you need to say or do with the child, as you stay present, then you will know what to do and what to say. And the child will always reflect back to you your state of consciousness. And then it will reflect back to you the presence. And it will grow up without losing presence. And that's a wonderful thing, because our old generation had to lose it and then painfully find it again, but find it this time consciously. But this now it's a wonderful thing when children grow up with conscious parents. So that's it's a beautiful thing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eckhart. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you very much.
Thank
wonderful.
You.
Have a great night. So it's time now for our final caller. I'm going to dial her as well. Thank you so much for answering that question, Eckhart, and thank you to Suzanne for asking it. Children definitely they're so much more conscious than us to begin with, and it's wonderful if we can help them to remain more present as they grow up into adulthood. Dialing Jill now.
Hello.
Hello, Jill?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air with Eckhart Tolle. Go ahead. What's your question?
Hello, Jill.
Thank you, Marie. Hello. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity, Marie and Eckhart. It's a wonderful pleasure to speak with you tonight.
Oh, thank you.
We've been seeing so much evidence of ego run amok through power and control with the Wall Street corruption, with the issues surrounding the Catholic Church and inner politics here in the United States becoming so divisive. What intent can we put forth to bring about more unity, compassion, and humility when surrounded by immense power? And what traits do you feel make for a great leader?
Ah, yes. Well, thank you for that question. Yes, you can see a lot of, if you want an example of the ego in action and its dysfunctional mode, you can listen to very politicians arguing, and a lot of that has been happening. So it's still the case that many politicians are drawn to politics because of certain egoic needs, with a few notable exceptions. And there's nothing much, unless you are a politician or you decide to go into politics being a conscious person, you decide to bring some consciousness into it and start somewhere. That's a perfectly wonderful thing to you to do, very challenging indeed to go into that and bring a different energy and a different consciousness into that. But it would be wonderful if more people who are actually awake or awakening would choose to do that and go into. Now, if you don't want to be part of that, and that certainly has never been my desire to be part of that, you can at least observe and support those few politicians who at least seem to be more conscious than others. There are some. Of course, we have the president, certainly a dramatic change from what we had before. No matter what you believe about President Obama, whether you think he hasn't fulfilled his promises or he hasn't done enough or this or that and he shouldn't have done this or that, there's no doubt that the underlying consciousness that he brings to his interactions and so on has more presence to it than almost any other politician. This is not to say that because he has to deal with vast energy movements, being president of a country like the United States, a vast country with vast energy movements, of course, he will sometimes go wrong. He will make mistakes. I believe he's already making some, but that's my personal belief is Afghanistan is probably a mistake, but I'll be very happy if I'm wrong in that. Nevertheless, I still find it a joy to observe him interact with human beings in a non-reactive way, allowing others to speak and then presenting his point of view. He still had to learn certain things. We know that how to be a leader is not enough to continuously allow others their position because they might take advantage of it. And on the whole, I feel it's already a wonderful thing that a person who, compared to many of his predecessors, could be almost be called a Buddha in relative terms. I'm saying compared to his predecessors, in the same way that the same thing happened in Russia, Soviet Russia, when Gorbachev came to power. He was actually, all Gorbachev was a sane person. He was not insane. And that the contrast between him and his predecessors was so vast that some people actually thought he must be a Buddha. But all that it was, he was not insane. That was so rare. And so the fact that even if you don't agree with everything he does, the fact that a relatively conscious person and a vastly more conscious person than many of his predecessors and many others in politics was elected, I think that is good news for the country, and it's a good sign. It's not so much that the fact that he's black that is a good thing, that is also good because that the prejudice was overcome. I'm not saying there's no prejudice at all, but that would have been impossible for a black person, to, as everybody knows, to be elected 30 years ago, 20 years ago even. But more importantly, that somebody was elected who brings a certain consciousness to this. Whether, to what extent he succeeds in what he does, remains to be seen. But it is good to know that there's something there that is definitely a manifestation of a shift. Now, let's see what happens. We need more conscious people to go into politics and start. You have to start somewhere, organize some people who don't continuously accuse, who don't continuously point their finger at others, who don't continuously condemn and so on, always seek to blame. And so we need people who bring that in. So I encourage anybody let's say you've just lost your job in the recession and you are an awakening human being, why not consider politics? See what you can do there. Don't expect not to be challenged. You're going into a collective energy field that is still vastly unconscious, and yet play with it. Go into that. Do what you can. Do your best. Stay present. And so I'm sure this start on a local level. Get yourself elected. Listen to people. Pay attention. See what they want. Bring that energy in. I could also say you choose other fields that are traditionally unconscious. Go into work. I don't know if I'm serious about this. Go into a Wall Street. See if you can bring consciousness to that. That's a big job, a huge challenge. But it may be possible. It may be possible. So some people may feel they want to do that, and I would encourage that. The awakening humans need to go out into this world, those who feel the inner impulse, to begin to bring a different energy. So don't complain, though, once you go in, how unconscious everybody around you is. You knew that from the start, didn't you? And that's fine.
Well, thank you so much for your question, Joe.
Thank you, Marie, and thank you, Eckhart.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have a wonderful night. Well, Eckhart, we are out of time. I wish we could spend all night talking. There's so many more questions, but I want to thank you so much for your time. And is there anything that you'd like to close the show with?
No, just we all know what's needed. It's all, you are the solution. Not your solution is not out there. You are the answer. You are the solution. Don't expect others to be conscious. Just live it yourself. And don't be discouraged when you meet the challenges, when you meet the unconsciousness. You cannot not meet it moving in this world that's going through a shift. You will meet unconsciousness in the form of other humans or groups or institutions. Just be present, do the best you can, and above all, don't get lost in the doing. Remain rooted in the being. Remain rooted in presence as you do. Being is primary. Doing is secondary. And that's fairly quite simple, really.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Eckhart. It has been a wonderful pleasure speaking with you tonight.
Thank you so much to everybody, and blessings, and good night.
Good night. Namaste.
Namaste.
So that was Eckhart Tolle. What a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful guest. I know that many of the people in the chat room were saying that they just felt in bliss listening to him, and it was such a beautiful experience speaking with Eckhart. I want to thank him again for being on the show. And if you would like to continue this discussion after the show, you're welcome to go to namastepublishing.com. And if you go to the community tab, under that there's forums and active discussions, and there's a forum right there, discuss Eckhart's interview on Namaste Radio. So again, that is namastepublishing.com. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Thank you to all of you who posted your questions. Thank you to our three callers, Kathleen, Suzanne, and Jill, for sharing your wonderful questions. And, of course, thank you again to the wonderful Eckhart Tolle for spending the evening with us. If you enjoyed this show and you are a member of Blog Talk Radio, I would like to invite you to please favorite the show. And how you do that is on the Blog Talk Radio player, there's a little heart icon, and if you press the heart icon, it will favorite the show, and then every week you'll get an email about an hour before each episode so you never miss an episode. And, of course, if you are not a member of Blog Talk Radio, if you become one, then you can join in on the interactive chat room each week where other listeners are able to talk amongst themselves. So again, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It has been an absolute pleasure. I have just enjoyed this 90 minutes so immensely. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Eckhart Tolle, and thank you to everyone who has spread the word about the episode. Please continue to share this. It is available on demand as a podcast. So we would encourage you to share this with your friends as well, and I hope to see you on Namaste Radio, or rather namastepublishing.com, if you would like to join in the active discussion to keep this going. I know when there are so many wonderful questions and so much guidance brought forth, a lot of times it brings up even more questions. So if you'd like to discuss that more, go to the forums and active discussions at namastepublishing.com. And as we end the show, I'm going to play a song that is inspired by Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth. It's called A Brand New World by Joe Wilson, and it is also available for download at namastepublishing.com in the store. I believe it's 99 cents for the download. So I'm going to close the show with this song, Brand New World by Joe Wilson. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening. Please share the show. Namaste.
There's a new wind blowing across the earth. It's bringing with it a brand new birth. The lamb and the lion will lay down side by side. They will live together in a brand new. Thank you.
thank you so much again for tuning in to Namaste Radio this evening. I've been your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to share this time with you. Again, I know that there are a lot of questions that came forth, and we had a very limited amount of time to speak with Mr. Tolle. So I would encourage you to go to namastepublishing.com, go to the community section and the forums and active discussions, and you can find the space to talk about this show this evening, and more questions can be brought forth as well. David Ord, he is one of the authors, and he's also the network editor, I believe, the editing director of Namaste Publishing. I hope I'm saying that correctly. He has a blog called The Compassionate Eye, and he can also address some of the issues that were not covered tonight. I know that there are so many questions that everyone wanted to ask. I had 2 pages of questions that I wanted to ask myself, and we unfortunately weren't able to get through all of them. I do want to thank you so much for submitting your questions and let you know that we do value your input and we do value your wonderful questions. So please do go to namastepublishing.com, share them on the forums so that our other authors can address them in blogs and in future radio shows as well. And again, I'd like to invite you to share this show with others. And if you are a Blog Talk Radio member, just click on the little heart icon on the Blog Talk Radio player and you can favorite the show. That helps us with our ratings, and it also gives you a heads up every week that the show is starting. So thank you again for being with us. Have a wonderful evening, and we will see you soon.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.